Hey, audience, welcome to Culturally and Technically Legal, where we examine the intersections of culture, law, and technology. Today, we have a very, very, very special guest, U.S. Army Sergeant and State Representative of Connecticut, Mr. Hubert Delaney. So give us a little bit of background about what goes into that role, and also if you could just give us a little bit of background regarding, you know, your involvement as a sergeant.
So I've been in since August 23rd, 2015, so about a little over 8 years. I'm a military journalist. The official title is Public Affairs Mass Communication Specialist, but it's military journalism. They change the title every couple of years. My other role as a state rep, So as a military journalist, think of military public affairs as the bridge between the U.S. military and the outside world. So all news organizations, whether it's CNN, MSNBC, your local news organization, for the most part, get their information about the military from the military. So soldiers like me, my soldiers, and soldiers like me and my soldiers. I've been extremely proud. I've been doing that since I was around 21. It's been one of the greatest honors of my life. I've been all over the world covering different operations and activities, from disaster relief in Texas to working on the border of Eastern Europe in Russian territories. I mean, it's been an incredible experience. As a state rep, like I mentioned before, my job is to work in the State House of Representatives for Connecticut and to represent my hometown there, to write laws on behalf of the state. To give you a little bit of an idea of, and I won't get too much into it right now because to give you some chance to ask a couple questions. But the idea is, you know, that we oversee the creation of new laws, the governance of the state, helping constituents navigate government programs, listening to constituents and forming those kinds of opinions. And so, you know, a lot of the things that you would expect that a congressperson would do, my colleagues and I do at a state level.
No, that's great. Recently, the governor of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, he passed a very important bill, and it was the AI Bill of Rights, right? And some major aspects of it is about, you know, digital and technological transparency, and just, you know, kind of blocking out opportunities for unlawful discrimination. Could you talk a little about that bill, the importance of it, and, you know, why it was important for this bill to be passed?
I absolutely can. So I'm really proud of the bill. It's one of the ones that I was working on and co-sponsored, and I'm really glad that it's there. But there's a few things about it. Firstly, I don't think the right way to think of it at this point is as a Bill of Rights yet. I think the term that I like using, or that I've heard that connects with me the most, is think of it as putting stakes in the ground to create the foundation of the house that will eventually become the Bill of Rights. So it does a few things. But essentially, it does two major ones. So the first one, it creates restrictions on the government. So what it does is we've mandated that all state agencies, so from our Environmental Protection Agency to our judicial branch, right, have to create an inventory of all the AI that is currently being used, right, and requires it annually that they're going to have to create an impact assessment on whatever AI technologies are being used, with a special provision to make sure that we're paying attention to make sure that those AI technologies don't discriminate against race or age, and that has to happen every year. But second, what it does, the most important part, in my opinion, is we create a working group. So essentially, we're taking 21 different professionals from the AI community, legislators, government officials, to work together to create the recommendations for what eventually will become the AI Bill of Rights, right? And so right now, they're taking stuff from the White House's blueprint on an AI Bill of Rights to other different kinds of documents to create a recommendation. So once we get into the next legislative session, we'll be able to work with that and turn that into what I'm hoping will eventually be a more substantive version of our Bill of Rights.
You talked a little bit about looking at what the U.S. is doing, and obviously you're on a state level policy and bill making. Now, do you think that we'll soon see a comprehensive federal plan around AI regulation and those privacy data regulations that we talked about briefly?
And I've got two reasons to say why I think that's happening, and both of them are pretty practical. The first one is that the White House has already come up with what they're calling it the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights. to allow experts and other government agencies to kind of start forming their own. But second, we're also kind of lighting a fire underneath them. So our attorney general, our state's lawyer, is working with 22 other attorney generals to kind of light a fire under the National Telecommunications and Information Administration to push them forward on more AI policies. But I think just moreover, I think that with the way that AI is affecting our industries, both government and civilian, I think it would be, I think it's completely within the realm of possibility. And I think not only are people demanding it, but I think we need it as a well-managed organization of government.
I agree with you. I can't agree with you more. So to backtrack briefly, right? You talked about some of the things that your attorney general is doing with other states, so on and so forth. What is the working relationship like for a state official like yourself and, federal officials and federal government? How do you guys work hand in hand for those people who don't necessarily understand how you guys have a foreign partnership?
Good question. I have a few answers to that. So the textbook answer, right, is that any powers that are not specifically outlined by the Constitution, that aren't given to the federal government, are given to the state. But my second answer is that in practice, it's much more collaborative than that. So, and whether it's funding or different projects, a lot of the things that I've been blessed enough to work on, whether it's funding for implementing our sidewalks or different agencies that kind of implement some of our policies as a government, a lot of it requires funding and coordination from the federal government, from the state government, from the municipal government that's being, that's implementing that policy. And then my third answer to that is on a personal level. One of the things that I've done and that I've looked at is kind of as a when the federal government might not be willing or able to step up to the plate, we as a state or state governments can step in, right? So to give you a concrete example of that, when one of the first campaign promises I ever made was actually for what's called our Reproductive Freedom Defense Act. Essentially, we saw the writing on the wall with Roe v. Wade, and created a policy that created some of the strongest reproductive and abortion protection policies in the state, specifically with the intent of allowing other states to be able to copy and use it for themselves. So I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. It answers it fully. And just to follow up to that, right? So you talked about kind of, where the state kind of have their rights at to create and improve laws for their particular citizens. Could you talk a little bit more of that, more so around like the Anti-Commandeering Act, how the government, such as the federal government, can't just impose certain things on state level governments? And when is there times, because we have seen in history, we look back, especially through the civil rights movement, where the government has stepped in and had to kind of overstep the state. When is that possible and when is that not possible?
Well, that's a very loaded question. I would say, again, I'll start off with a technical answer and then get down to a more practical and then a personal answer. So I think a good example at a technical perspective starts with our 10th Amendment, which essentially says that the federal government, like we talked about before, only has powers that are applicable in the Constitution. Commonly, like the common terms for it are states' rights or even before that, we called it federalism, which is basically the idea of a more restricted government. And I think the most impactful version of when we see that kind of in conflict, right, is when Supreme Court cases, when we have to argue whether or not a policy infringes on a state's ability to govern itself or whether the federal government may be overreaching. I would say that the best example of us working together through that would be what we like to call cooperative federalism, right? So let's say, for example, there is a restriction, right, legally on how the federal government can regulate highways, right? Or some such agency, right, or policy, right? What the federal government will do is they'll implement it through funding. So while they might not be able to come in and personally do it, what they can say is, all right, well, let's say our standard on blood alcohol limits is 0.08, right? If I'm tracking correctly. And what they can say is, well, if you implement this policy, you'll receive transportation funding. If you don't, you won't be eligible for it, right? So, in a technical perspective, the biggest restriction would be the 10th Amendment. right, what essentially restricts the federal government's ability to implement policies that would consider infringing on state government's ability to govern itself, right? I would say that the most practical version of that would be when we see court cases that argue the federal government or the state's government's ability to govern itself, right? And that the most personal way that I've seen it implemented or worked through and for an effective government has been through what's called cooperative federalism, wherein the federal government will create restrictions or guidelines for a policy. And if that state implements those guidelines, it'll free them up for more funding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely, totally. No, totally, man. And we have a different interview where we talk a little bit about spending and taxing clauses and how those things are at play. So we won't get too deep into that just now. Now, you talk about I think you hit on some great points, and obviously one of the big conversations around everything right now is immigration laws, right? And I would say Connecticut is definitely one of those more progressive places, I think, when I do look at the importance of immigration laws and how they're being upheld. Recently, however, Florida's new immigration law essentially states something directly to Connecticut citizens, saying, you know, they'll no longer essentially acknowledge these non-federal forms of identification as driver license from Connecticut when people are in Florida, right? So when I look at topics like that, I think it looks more like we're not necessarily united on that front. We're more of a divided states in that space and area. How does relationship state to state work regarding things of this nature? And let me know if you want me to reframe it. I was kind of went off on a tangent talking.
I would say that I think I'll start off on a personal level. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for how things are down in Florida. You know, I know that sometimes it can feel like Stamford is as different, or Stamford, Connecticut, where I'm from, can be as different from New York or Miami or Texas as it could be from Hong Kong. But what I will say is that I think one of the reasons why our policy is different is definitely because of our exposure to diversity. In Stanford, for example, we speak 75 different languages. And I know that's definitely having access to seeing those many folks, right, and all those different perspectives has definitely influenced me as a lawmaker. I would say, in how it works together, it's really a case-by-case basis, right? So, for example, you see a lot of coordination in the tri-state area. And so, for us, that tri-state is New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, in implementing either health strategies or, for example, our cannabis policies, right? But it really has to be a coordinated effort if there's a lack of federal guidelines.
No, I think you answered the question amazing. So just to kind of change gears for a moment, obviously there's different things going on in the world right now, and you talked about how, you know, being a member of the military, you've had access and contacts different countries, rather be reporting or, you know, just upholding your role and your military values. When you think about that in general, there's typical governing guidelines to various things that happen internationally, specifically with conflict. Could you briefly explain the importance of international humanitarian law and what exactly it is for those who might not know exactly what it is?
I absolutely can. I think that the best way to talk about international humanitarian law, or commonly known as rules of war, is to start for why they exist, and a general idea of what some of their basic tenets are, and then to get into a little bit about the history of it. The general idea behind rules of war is to protect non-combatants, right? So think of that as either people who aren't fighting, right, or people who are no longer able to fight, right? Some of the more well-known rules would probably be, freedom from torture, for detainees, making sure the detainees or rules or prisoners of war have food and water, allowing them to be able to communicate at home, making sure that medical professionals, whether that's combat medics or aid workers, that go into theaters of operation and combat zones are not targeted, right? And are able to not just assist one side, but all sides of folks who need medical care. I would say that the although there's been a diff although international rules of war have existed in some form or fashion over the last couple of hundred years for a long, long time, I would say that our international law as we know it, I would say first started around 1864 with the Geneva Convention, with the idea of placing restrictions on combatants, nations, nation states, right, in theaters of operation.
So we obviously talked about policies around artificial intelligence and on a state level, and we didn't jump too much into data privacy stuff. But when we think about international humanitarian law, do you think at some point or another they will have to be it will have to be inclusive of new technology, especially artificial intelligence, generative artificial intelligence, and you know what our Defense Department will deal with regarding that, regarding new weapons that will be produced utilizing AI. How much of an impact do you see that altering what we know as the international humanitarian law or rules of war, as you stated?
I would say that a good mentality that I have when it comes to laws in general, international, federal, or state, is that they're designed to be implemented and changed over time. And the same is true for international law. Since the inception of the international law, or the rules of war as we know them today, they have changed over time. I think the most notable version change probably would be after World War II. But as technology has changed, so have our rules of war. And then, to add, my own personal perspective on this, although I think that they have always been designed to be changed and updated, I do think it's necessary. I remember when I was in Eastern Europe for Operation Atlantic Resolve, we worked on what was called the first fully robotic breach. It was a operation where we had from the sweeping a first full operation that was controlled completely by robots. It was an incredible mission. The technology was beautiful. As a young journalist and soldier, it was great to cover it. But stuff like that does make you question, right? As our technology changes, as our perspective of, combat changes, making sure that our agreed upon standards are in keeping with our goals of protecting those who can't fight or are no longer able to.
No, I agree with you, and I want to go back to the state level for a moment. I know you briefly talked about technology changing, right? So I think about Privacy Act, for example, and the 1974 Privacy Act, right? Most recently, Connecticut passed their Data Privacy Act, right? Due to technology, due to data being exchanged at, really, really efficient and faster rates ever than before. What was the importance of that act, and how do you see that act impacting the future for consumers, right, specifically, and the obligations of many businesses within your state?
Absolutely. So I'm going to do my best to break down my answers. I would say for point one, the importance is data protection, to give people a little bit more control over where their data goes, to provide more protections for minors. I'm sorry, could you just rephrase some of the questions? I just wanted to make sure. So the first question was, why did
Yes.
we change policy and where do we see it? What does it do and where do we see it going?
Exactly, essentially.
Well, so the creation of the policy was to add more protections for people's individual data, right? Just like how we talked about with the rules of war, as the technology evolves, so do our policies for it. Some of the practical things that it does, which are slowly being implemented, well, some of the implementation of the policy has already started. Some of the start dates for some of the other provisions are going to be happening over time. But the key idea is that for businesses that are either based out of Connecticut, are marketing to folks in Connecticut, that are selling products to Connecticut, to create more restrictions on what they can do with people's data, right? So that's from online dating, social media protections, particularly health data, right? We wanted to create more restrictions against what was called geofencing. One of the things that people would do to collect and sell people's personally identifiable information, particularly with regards to their health care, their sexual orientation. It also creates more protections for minors. So it created the Connecticut Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, whose mission is to be able to follow through on and investigate instances of abuses, and cybercrimes against children. It also makes it a little bit easier for minors and the parents of minors, right, to decide where their children's data goes, right, and creates restrictions for things like our social media websites and other agencies that have had access to that information, right? So it creates provisions for parents to be able to demand that social media accounts be shut down, right? It gives children and those parents, guardians, the option to decide if that data is going to be shared. And the same is going to be true with our consumers too, although some of those policies are going to be rolling out between now and 2024. Where do I see it going? I see it just getting more comprehensive. I think as the policy starts to, I think, as is true with a lot of policies, once we start laying, now that we've laid the groundwork for a lot of this, and we start to see how it's implemented in the field, as people start to come up with suggestions or things that may or may not be working, I think we're going to be improving that, right? And as we start to see the technology evolve more, we're going to start creating more restrictions and putting more funding to make sure that people have more options. At least, while I can't speak for other legislators, that is my personal goal.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think too, I think something you should talk to a little bit is I think people don't really realize how important it is to participate and vote in local and state elections and not just presidential. What would be your perspective on that? Obviously, you hold the role that you do, you know the importance, but what could you share with us of the importance of it that we may not even talk about in this conversation?
Absolutely. So I would first, your elections, especially your local elections, matter, whether it's what's being taught in your schools, how we're being policed, what our taxes are, what our streets and sidewalks look like. All of those and more are affected by local elections. And two, I would say that people's participation does matter, that you should go out to vote, you should consider running. If I'm being practical about it, I've met if you have a topic or a specialty that you're interested in, I recommend trying to find either a federal or state agency that works on that, a activist organization that participates in changing those policies, and consider volunteering and voting. We need all the people that we can get, and I'm personally not turning anyone away.
No, that's amazing. And I'm going to ask you one more question before you head out. I know it's a busy day for you. As you and I both know, we must pay a great homage to our ancestors, those who come before us, those who kind of helped us get to the place that we're in, whether indirectly or directly. And probably one of my favorite, civil rights activists is Cecil B. Moore, because I'm from Philly, obviously. But your grandfather, Hubert Delaney. And literally one of the first black judges in the state of New York, an icon in the civil rights movement, a lawyer to Martin Luther King. Why is it important for you to carry his legacy and in everything you do, from policymaking to lawmaking to being a state rep and just overall just being an advocate for people in general? Talk to the importance of carrying on that legacy and why it's important for you to uphold it.
Important for me to carry it because it constitutes the makeup of who I am as a person. I would not be here without the army of people, from my aunties and uncles to my ancestors who lifted me up and put me where I am now. I would say that the two practical ways that I try to carry his legacy and the legacy of my family with me, in a practical sense, I would say from last year, we got to work on what was called the Connecticut Voting Rights Act. One of the things that really impacts how legislation is pushed is, people, the boots on the ground, the folks who can put rubber to the road on advocating for a policy. And, my great grandfather, Hubert the First, before he passed, helped establish the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which at the time was designed to help the civil rights leaders of the civil rights era afford and get representation. Has now turned into a civil rights activist organization that promotes civil rights policies. We worked together to create the Connecticut Voting Rights Act. Essentially, what we did is we took the Voting Rights Act of 1964, which had slowly lost a lot of its provisions due to our Supreme Court. What we did is we took those policies, we tailor-made them for Connecticut, and then implemented it as a law. And now Connecticut has some of the strongest voting rights protections in the state, in the country. And I'm really, really proud of that. But I think, you know, at a personal level, what I carry with me is a quote from Hubert the First that there but for the grace of God go I. You know, I never got a chance to meet my great grandfather, but I love listening to his speeches. And one of the things he said when addressing a congregation, what the only difference between him and another person of a different faith or gender, ethnicity, or social background was that he was born where he was and that other person was born where they are. And I try to carry that with me. I try not to be focused on trying to be the perfect soldier or the best lawmaker, but being the best person that I can be, you know, and recognize that there but for the grace of God go I.
Oh, man, that was deep, inspirational, and enlightening to say the least, man. I'm so happy we were able to get you on here. I know it's a busy day. Every day is busy for you, I'm sure, at this point. But thank you again for joining us and having such an insightful conversation. Obviously, we're looking forward to having you on here again one of these days and share even more. But thank you so much, Mr. Hubert, and just wishing you greatness, moving forward.
Thank you for having me. And if I were to say anything to everyone watching, you know, I would say that I know it can feel like democracy is or getting involved in your government can be this big, mysterious, you know, unfriendly thing. And there's no confusion that it can be difficult. But if you're willing to open up the door to trying to make a change or to make a difference, there's going to be people on the other side of it. And if you're willing to fight, we need all the help we can get.
Thank you all for watching another episode of Culturally and Technically Legal. We had obviously a very, very amazing guest, Hubert, today. Thank you again, and be on the lookout for the next episode. Thank you.